Ja. The second chapter of Megillas Rus tells us much about Rus and also tells us quite a bit about Naomi as well, even though we got introduced to them previously. But as we see them living together, we see them interacting, we learn more about them as individuals, and we also learn more about not only how they looked at life, but how we should look at life, and how we should treat others, and how we should see things that happen to us, through what light, through what prism. So today we're going to learn Pasuk Yutes, the 19th Pasuk, the 19th verse in the second chapter of Megillas Rus. The brief background is that Rus has an extraordinary day of successful collecting. You'll remember she comes to this field, she's a stranger. Boaz welcomes her. He treats her so beautifully. He makes her feel relaxed and comfortable and worthy, restores her dignity, and then he gives her some food. And Ruth doesn't want any favors, though. She's very pleased to have her dignity restored, and even though Boaz tries to create a situation where, charity is going to be given by accidentally leaving things behind, Ruth is extremely perceptive and intuitive, and she doesn't take any of that. And she only takes what's rightfully hers. And she works very diligently. But despite the fact that she worked diligently, it was less, or perhaps not only her diligence, but exceptional bracha, incredible blessing from Hashem, that allows Rus to succeed in a way that's really beyond expectation. We'll call it defying statistics. And she's finally coming home. Naomi doesn't know where her daughter lives all day, and she's very anxious. And we learned last week that Naomi went out to the city gates to greet her, to find out. She was nervous. And they meet, and there's a wordless exchange. A wordless exchange that spoke volumes. That was last week's class. And today is going to be a mouthful exchange, a very wordy exchange, or at least a very wordy kind of pasuk, a lot of words, which on the surface seem almost like blabbering. But of course, chas v'shalom, that first of all, Naomi doesn't blabber, and second of all, the Torah wouldn't have to tell us if she blabbered. Why would the Torah convey that to us for posterity? But you'll see that as we learned last week from the wordless conversation, we'll learn even more from the words that were uttered. Okay, so Pasuk Yutes. Now the microphone shifts to Naomi. In the previous verse, all Naomi did was she looked. It was eye language, like Ruth and Naomi understood each other from the way she looked at the package, the way she already knew what had to be done. Now, Vatoimer lo chamoiso, her mother-in-law says to her, Eferlikat, where did you gather all this? Follow along inside, because this is really important to see how this conversation seems to unfold. Eferlikatayim, where did you gather everything today? Then, Va'ona asis, and where did you do? Yehi makirech baruch. Let the person who recognizes you be blessed. Vatageid lechamoisa. So she responds to her mother-in-law. Es asher osesa ime, what she did with him. Vatoimer, and then she said, Shem ha'ish asher osise ime, the person that I did all this with, hayoim today, Boaz. A totally disjointed conversation. First of all, Naomi's firing questions. Questions of no consequence. And if you want to answer to your question, why don't you wait for the answer? Like, why are you asking questions? Yesterday, like Burma, I was putting on film with a lot of people. So really, I don't ask anybody if they're Jewish, even though sometimes halfway through my conversation, I realize I better because there's a number of non-Jewish people there also. And, it's just say Shalom Aleichem. First of all, I tell them I recognize them. When that's absolutely not correct, I say I confuse you with somebody. And this is how we get at the conversation. And, 99 times out of 100, the sleeve goes up and they put on tefillin. All right. But then there's always the obnoxious people. These are people who usually put on tefillin already. So they're offended. How dare I ask them if they put on tefillin? Well, if you don't wear a yarmulke, like, what do you want? How am I supposed to know? Most people who put on tefillin, they usually wear a yarmulke. I'm sorry. So he says to me, did you put on tefillin? So I said to him, what are you going to do about it if I didn't? So he said, I'll put on tefillin with you. I said, really, with whose tefillin? With which tefillin are you going to put on with me? He said, the ones in your hand. I said, I don't understand. You're asking me to put on tefillin the ones in my hand? He said, I asked you out of concern. I concern a fellow Jew didn't do a mitzvah he should do today. I asked you out of concern. Why are you asking me the question? If you're concerned for me, then you would have to have a pair of tefillin in your hands. So he said, okay, I'm sorry, Erica. In other words, the question was just being obnoxious. Like, okay, I don't mean to be a nudge. They did a gewaldige thing yesterday at the Earl Bills. They gave everybody these little stickers. If you put on tefillin already, they put a little sticker on you. You shouldn't be asked 50 times. So the people were walking around with these round stickers that said, I put on tefillin, check. Unfortunately, they put it on their knapsacks. I didn't see the sticker all the time. And then as soon as he sees me coming, like, he's pointing at a sticker. You know? So when you ask a question, if you're polite and if you're sincere and there's like some integrity here about this exchange, if you ask a question, what do you wait for? An answer. You have, like, people say, how are you? But they don't wait for the response. Mm-hmm. So why did you ask how I am? It's even funny when you do it on the phone. Or people don't know you at all. Like, how are you? What's doing? Do you need something? Like, why are you asking these questions? Why is Naomi firing questions? Number one, where did you gather today? And where did you do it? I mean, first of all, you just asked where I gathered this today. Then you want to know where I did it. What's the difference between lakat and asis? Where did you do it and where did you gather it? And without waiting for any answer, all of a sudden she says, oh, yehi makirech baruch. Whoever recognized you, she's already making assumptions. It's like a wonderful conversation. She holds the whole conversation. She asks questions, he gives the answers, she does the follow-up. It seems very strange. Yehi makirech baruch. So she asks two questions, and without waiting for any answers, she's already blessing the imaginary person or the assumption that she made that somebody must have been nice to you. So how does Rus respond? First of all, it says, V'taged lecha ma'isa esa asher asa so imay. She told her mother-in-law what she did with him. With who? V'toymer. And she said, Shem ha'ish, the name of the man, asher asisa imay, that I did with him. So two times, what did you do with him? You didn't do anything with him. I mean, you got tzedakah. You did with him. You should know the thing I did, hayoyim, it's boyaz. What kind of answer is that? And why it says we use two very different words, vatageid and then vatoimar. And I'm going to share with you the most famous example, but there are many examples of this throughout the Chumash. Many examples of it. That the kind of word that's used for speech is telling. It conveys a message. There's a difference between amira and hagoda. They're not the same. In general, the Hebrew language, which is a sacred tongue, and not a composite language, which is put together from many languages, has one word for each thing. There are no redundant words. In English, there are many redundant words. And the redundancy stems from the fact that English is a hodgepodge of languages. There's old French, and there's a little bit of German, and there's the Latins, and there's a little bit of Spanish. It's a mixture. So every mixture is going to have different languages, and one of the things that linguists do is they trace the etymology of a word, which is quite interesting to know where the word comes from. And oftentimes when you trace the etymology of a word back to its origin, its country of origin, it speaks to you about the kind of people who live there or the kind of culture which is popular in that place. My favorite example of this is an English word called Schadenfreude. Never heard it. Schadenfreude. You heard it. What does it mean? You rejoice in somebody else's misery. A nice word. It's German, thank you. That's what, enough said. The word Schaden in German is damages. And Freuden or Freuden is happiness. Schadenfreuden. Who gets happy from damages? Well, nobody. But you can get happy from somebody else's damages if you want to. There happens not to be another word like this in English. This is the only one. But there are many, many words that have come down to English from different sources, and because they come from different places, they will be telling and compelling, and oftentimes repeated. So there's a word like, there's so many examples of this. Anyway, I don't want to get into language, but the bottom line is in Hebrew, no words are redundant. And I don't mean Ivrit, because Ivrit is also a hodgepodge. Ivrit has many languages that have been brought in to create modern Hebrew. I'm talking Biblical Hebrew. In Biblical Hebrew, every single word means only one thing. There are no two words for the same thing. Now, the question becomes, What happens when words seem redundant? What happens when we see three words or four words for saying, for communicating, for verbalizing? Must be a difference. Would you believe it? There is. There's a difference in dibur and amira and hagada. There are differences. What's the basic difference? So this is a very famous one that most people know, because it's a Rashi and the Chumash, and because it's part of who we are as a people. Like, getting the Torah was a defining moment, and the defining moment of getting the Torah was preceded by Hashem making the offer, and then we accept it. And then Moshe Rabbeinu got instructions, what he should tell us. So it says, the famous pasuk says, "Koy sagid livnei Yisrael, the koy soymar lebeis Yaakov." This is what you should say or tell the sons of Israel. This is what you should speak or say to the house of Jacob. Who is Beis Yisrael? And who is Bnei Yisrael? Who is Beis Yaakov? Who are these two nations? Men and women. Men and women. Rashi famously says that Haggadah is kosher, harsh talk, tough talk. That soimar is softly spoken words. And interestingly, even in English it fits. Tough talk, soft speaking. Well, first of all, these are two women speaking. If they're two women speaking, why would they use the term vatagid? You know how you understand the word vatagid? But a haggadah is a telling. Like the haggadah shopetzel is a telling. V'igar talavincha. In English, when you tell somebody off, was that like a nice conversation? Ah, I told him. I told him off. What does that mean? That's like, I'm upset about something. I told him off. Nobody says it off. So even in English, this holds true. Even. So why does Ruth start as Vatage lechama isa esa shir asa seyme? She told her mother-in-law off. What she did with him? But then when it came to saying Shema Isha Shirasisi Imai, when she described the person, then all of a sudden she was talking softly. She said, this guy was bias.
Maybe because she was wondering how she got so much.
There's got to be reasons for all of this. We can try to figure it out now. But before we figure out the Pasuk, I'm trying to show you how and why the Pasuk needs elucidation. You read this verse straight, it's not a straight read. Everything about this Pasuk is screaming in the language that Rashi likes to use, darsheni. Darsheni comes to the word drasha, which is in Hebrew from lidrosh, which can be a homily, but also be to investigate. It's like, look into me. This is a very, very laden verse, as is every biblical verse. You can never read the Bible. You can only study it. Because if you read it, you miss the point.
Maybe Ruth sort of felt that Naomi implies that something not kosher.
Very good. Okay, hold that thought. Very good, yeah. Clearly, Rus is responding in like a tough way. She's clearly responding to something. What is going on over here? So first of all, on a very literal level, what comes across in this verse, in one word, is anxiety. Whose anxiety?
Naomi's
anxiety. So now we know that Naomi is an anxious person? No. Now we know that she's an anxious mother-in-law. I know anxious mothers. I don't know so many anxious mother-in-laws. It's not the same. A mother's relationship with her daughter and a woman's relationship with her daughter-in-law are not the same. The Mishnah says it. The Mishnah about it. There's that famous joke where a fellow introduces his mother to three young women. And he says, Mom, who am I marrying? And she says, the brunette one in the middle. He said, how did you know? She said, I couldn't stand there for the second they laid eyes on her. It's a terrible joke. But so true, huh? Vei Yizmir. Okay, but this is a Mishnah. The Mishnah says, certain nashim shecheske seine zuazu. The assumption is that the relationship is strained. That's the assumption the Mishnah says. It doesn't mean it can't be great. There are some mother-in-law daughters have amazing relationships. But more often than not, the relationship is strained. And there's a whole psychology behind that, which has nothing to do with this class. Here is my point, though. By telling us about Naomi's anxiety, what we have just been conveyed is something extraordinary. Something extraordinary. Naomi was worried about Ruth. Naomi was a person who cared deeply about Ruth. This talks about their relationship. If somebody asks questions about where were you, how are you, you could either get offended and say, why are you asking me? Or you could say, well, thank you for caring. So I asked somebody a few weeks ago, I said, where were you in shul last week? And they said to me, do I have to answer to you? I said, oh, Yezmir, I'm sorry for caring. I'm sorry. I shouldn't care if you're coming out. He said, oh, I'm sorry. He realized he was being, I'm not coming to intrude on people's lives. If I ask somebody where he was, I care if somebody's there or not. Now, I know sometimes that if you can, you smother somebody with care, so you have to be careful not to care too much. I mean, or to care, but not to like kind of become stifling or people want their freedom also. Okay, and I understand that. And sometimes we're better at that or worse at that, but here's what the most important here. The most important thing is you should care. I read a book many, many years ago. Somebody advised me I should read this book before I start what I'm doing. It's called Tales at a Shul. Written by a rabbi who wrote his experiences. Very interesting book. And here's a line from the book, which stayed with me. It said, a rabbi should be a good administrator, a rabbi should be a good orator, a rabbi should be a good teacher, a rabbi should be a good counselor, a rabbi should be a good an efficient delegator, a whole list of things, other things he writes. And he said, but if a rabbi is not some of those things, his congregation will forgive him. He said, even if a rabbi is not any of those things, his congregation might forgive him. He said, there is one thing that a rabbi's congregation will never forgive him for. And then he leaves like a pause. And the next line he says, a congregation will never forgive a rabbi who doesn't care. It's a very powerful line. Why? Because you have to care. If you don't care about people, then what's the whole... And a lot of rabbis don't care, but it's not their fault because they're jaded. Because they yelled at and screamed at. Eventually it's like, leave me alone. I can't deal with this anymore. A rabbi I knew once, an older rabbi, said, I said, I gotta retire. I said, why? He said, I told him the rabbi didn't believe in retirement. He said, because I hate everybody already. They're taking my kishkas out. I can't deal with it. I don't care about anybody anymore. I said, okay, you should retire, Taka. Then you should retire. I said, don't retire from life. Find a new thing to do. If Rus doesn't ask, is not being asked questions, understood. Rus is going to be a little frustrated here. She's going to respond. You're right. You picked up, you twigged onto it. She's about target. She did tell her mother-in-law off a little bit, and very, very, very subtly. She was a little bit, like maybe a drop offended from something which we'll see in a moment. Perhaps, you know, rightfully. But more importantly, what we see here is the essence of a relationship, of a true relationship. Because the friendship and the kinship and the bond between Naomi and Ruth is like something that stories are told about. It's legendary. And what is the foundation of that legendary relationship? She cared. She cared. The fact that she cares, it's a very, very, very meaningful thing already. Many years ago, I once went down to the Israeli consulate to complain about something with a group of people, very upset about certain things that the Israeli government was doing. And they were, you know, dislodging Jews from their homes and so on and so forth. And it was a very heated and tense conversation that we had. And the consul general, at some point, started to yell at me. He was really angry at me. And then I realized that this whole conversation is too angry. And we had to, like, take it down a few notches. So I let him scream a little. I said, listen here, Mr. So-and-so, do you realize that we're here because we care? I said, we are not your enemy. Your enemy is apathy. Your enemy is the thousands or tens of thousands who don't care. They're not supporting what you do. They don't care what you're doing. I said, you should be happy that we came down here. We're not bored people. We came down here because we care. And because you're supposed to be the consul general, and we want you, asking you to send a message home to your boss, whoever that is, and send a message home to the prime minister's office that the Jews in the diaspora are disturbed and angry and frustrated. We care. Don't be angry at me for caring. You may not like what we're saying. You may not agree. But don't. Anger is no place for that because we care. Naomi cares deeply about Ruth. And that's counterintuitive. It's not necessarily the natural thing. Remember, it's mother-in-law, daughter-in-law. If Naomi was Ruth's mother, okay, every mother's anxious. But here, the anxiety, and then even after she sees her, okay, maybe she's worried. She's a young girl in a new place, and maybe she was going to be abused, chas v'shalom. She's worried. She saw her. She saw she's healthy already. And she's still now, even after she saw she's healthy, and she even had a bite to eat. Sometimes anxiety comes out of hunger. Naomi's starving. She's home all day starving, and Ruth is out there. Naomi gave her her food. Remember that we learned the lesson. Ruth gives Naomi half of her lunch. So Naomi is not starving anymore. At least she shouldn't be starving. She must have had a bite to eat. According to the Mefarshim, she did nibble. She was so hungry. So she had a nibble already. So it's not anxiety out of hunger. It's not anxiety out of guilt that something happened to Rus, because she saw nothing happen to Rus, and Rus is doing perfectly fine. So then what is the anxiety from? She cares. That's number one. Okay. But the conversation has to make sense. So besides the fact that Megillas Rus conveys to us something extraordinary about Naomi and Rus's relationship, that it's a caring relationship, the next thing we have to understand is, so what was the questions? The question was, Eifoy likat hayom, where did you gather today? What is the question, where did you gather today? How many days did Rus go and gather? Has she been away for a week? 2 weeks? 4 days? 2 days? She left in the morning and she came back at night. So what's Eifoy likat hayom? Where did you gather that today? And not when? Yesterday? Tomorrow? When else could she have gathered? There wasn't another possibility. The reason we specify things in a conversation is because we want to be specific. I want to tell you what I'm asking, what I'm looking for. So Eifoy likat, where did you glean? That's reasonable. You know, she cares about her. She's anxious to know about her welfare. How did your day go? There's a story they tell about a husband that came home and he's fighting with his wife. And he says, you know the problem, he says? You never even ask me how my day was. I come home, and right away you're henpecking me. You never ask me how my day is. She says, okay, fine. I'll try to change that. The next day he walks in. She says, good afternoon, honey. How was your day? He says, don't even ask. She asked, hayu eifoy likat? What's hayoyim? So what we see from this is, and the word eifoy, which is eifoy means? But eifoy, we learned last week, means? A measure. Ah, a very large measure. Not eifo, but eifo. How much did she gather? Take a look back in verse 17. Vatalaket besada ad ha'orev. She worked until evening. Vatach baita seshel liketo. Then she beat down the grain. Now how does the pasuk finish? Vayi ke eifo se'orim. After removing the chaff of the stalk, she still has an eifo. Ah, says the Ibn Shushan. Here is the trick. This is the hint to the question. Eifoy likat hayom is not just where were you, but Naomi is really asking, how did you do so well today? Something extraordinary just unfolded here. It's not just ordinary anxiety. Naomi is very perceptive. And in her perception, she notices an enormous amount of grain, what we're going to call unexpected. Like we said, it's a blessing. Blessing of the things that are not statistical, not expected. So she says, how'd you do that in one day? In eifoy, likat, hayoin? You got an eifo in one day? Only in Hebrew could this work. How do you translate this in English? How do you translate the eifo, where, is also meaning the same Hebrew letters of eifo? You can't. As has been said so many times, you cannot translate the Bible into English. Certainly not in a way it could be studied. You always have to go back to the original Hebrew. Even if you don't know Hebrew, take the Hebrew-English translation, but go back to the Hebrew. So this is what's called a pun intended. This is a loaded question. The words being used are so carefully chosen. So she's anxious and she says, an eifa? Eifa where? Eifa? Soma? Likat, you collected gleanings hayoyim? And always, is this all from the gleanings? It's all from the gleanings? What's going on over here? Like, how could that be? So this was the big question. And the other question then becomes, va'ana asis. What's va'ana asis? So the ma'am lawyers, where did you work? But eifoy likat, where did you glean? So when I was ana asis, where did you do? Where did you glean and where did you do? So the ma'am lawyers, quoting Rav Achrein, he says something so beautiful. Naomi is making assumptions. We all make assumptions. By the way, assumptions is not such a good thing to make. There's a joke about, if you break up the word assumptions, it's an ASS out of you and me, because we made assumptions. Shouldn't make assumptions, but we make assumptions. We tend to do them. Naomi's assumption is, It's not possible that she gleaned this much in one day. So she must have got a job. So some gleanings, there was some working. The problem, of course, the working is, if she would have worked, why would she get paid in raw commodities? Why would she get paid in food? She needs food. She needs food to eat. She's starving. So if he pays cash, fine. But she didn't pay cash. Why would she come with raw stocks? And anyway, she had lunch, so she must have gotten paid something. So this is what Naomi's asking. What went on today? What was going on? What happened out of the field? Eifelikat, assuming that she has grain, so she must have gathered, but also Va'ana Asis. And where did you do this work? And at any rate, she says, Yihi Makirech Baruch. Whoever recognized you, whoever took care of you, whoever gave you a job, you know, new immigrant to the country, gave you a job, may be blessed. May be blessed. So she's saying, I'm happy. I'm not like Rus, like, what, are you not happy that I was successful? It's like, how dare you do so well? Are you not happy? She said, no, I'm so happy. I'm delighted. I blessed the person who made you this with the success. So I don't know how that happened. And there's an undercurrent here of maybe their intentions aren't pure. Maybe whoever was so nice to you is, I mean, this is a beautiful woman, beautiful young lady. Maybe somebody's got other ideas and Naomi wants to protect her. So it's almost like a subtle accusation of whoever was nice to you, but maybe they weren't so nice to you. I mean, I hope they're good. I hope they're blessed. I hope this is all sincere, above board, with best of intentions. She's worried, and there's like this subtle accusation almost leveled against Boaz. Not against Ruth, but against Boaz. And Ruth is offended by that because she knows, she saw how righteous Boaz is. So how does she respond? Vatageid lecha moisa. She tells her off. But not telling her off, but if the Torah uses the Megillah, Ruth chooses with Vatageid. What's Vatageid? Tell. She tells. She tells the Chamoisa, Eis asher asesa imai, what she did with him. So when she tells what she did with him, which we're soon going to see this expression, did with him, it should be what he did with her. But did with him, she's like mother-in-law. Please, Shviger, Nak, why would you accuse somebody? That's not fair. That's unbecoming of you. Now, of course, Naomi is only speaking this way out of anxiety and concern for Rus. And yet, Rus is still upset that Naomi would suspect somebody. And perhaps what Naomi said was perfectly justified. And perhaps what Naomi said was perfectly appropriate, that she should be worried. She had good reason to be concerned. Rus was a little bit in a dangerous situation. But Naomi doesn't understand what Rus has happened to Rus today. And Rus is offended emotionally because this person was so good to her. If you remember, a few weeks ago we learned she restored her dignity. She felt like a schlepper. She felt like a schnorrer. Like didn't belong here. Like an immigrant. A once upon a time princess reduced to a pauper gathering gleanings in the field. And this person gave her a sense of worth, a sense of self-dignity and value. So it was hard, it was hurtful for Ruth to hear these words of mother-in-law to suggest that Boaz was anything less than 100% honest and well-intentioned and caring and concerned without chas v'shalom, any kind of negativity. So it doesn't mean telling her off, it doesn't say he told her off, just as vatagid. Vatagid. It gives us now, what this also says to us is how appreciative Rus was. Another human quality which is not so common. It's called appreciation. And especially when somebody does a big favor for you, the intuitive thing to do is not to appreciate it too much. Why? Who wants to be a schnorrer? Who wants to be a schlepper? The story is told about the Chassam Sofer. It said it about others also. I don't know which version of it is true or older versions of it is true, but if you have open eyes and you know about human nature, they're all true, or they could be true. So the story was that somebody once came, the Chassam Sofer was giving a shir to a group of disciples. A person walked in and started to hurl insults at the Chassam Sofer and call him all kinds of names, and God should judge you. And the Chassam Sofer's disciples were shocked. Was shocked. He wanted to get up and manhandle this. I said, look, let him, whatever. And when it was finished and he walked out, the Talmidim said to the Rebbe, what did you do to him? The Chassam Sefer said, he says, I have no idea what this guy wants from me. Trust me, he says, I didn't even do him a favor. What does that mean? So there's this Yiddish proverb that when you do somebody a really big favor, give them a bag of stones. So they ask me why, but you give a bag of stones. So they say, the Yiddish proverb finishes, as a dvar fin steiner, zon ze zayn kleiner. He's going to throw rocks at you. At least provide him with the ammunition. It'll be small stones, otherwise it'll be boulders. What's behind this? The psychologists say that nobody likes to feel ingratiated. Nobody likes to feel totally dependent on others. So our mind, very very sadly actually, our mind works from saying, he did me a favor? Who did him a favor? You think I needed you? You think I couldn't do this without you? We don't want to be in a state of neediness. Nobody wants to be in a state of having a handout, of feeling dependent. Dependency is not a good feeling. So to protect ourselves, subconsciously, we become less appreciative, which is another part of the intuitive nature of humanity, which is not positive. But there are a lot of things about human nature which are not positive. Greed, selfishness, laziness, I could go on. The Torah says we're created with lots of toxins and imperfections. Why? So we should make a parade and dance about it and tell everybody how great we are? No, so we should work on it and change it. And when we work on change and refine ourselves and overcome our natural tendencies, that's when we're ready to receive the Torah, which is the whole idea of Pesach to Shavuos, Sefirot Ta'omer. Elevate yourself, enhance yourself, fix yourself, even one tiny bit at a time. Make little changes. Smallest change is a big deal. So with regard to this exchange over here, where Rus has this maybe natural almost desire not to be so gracious, not to be so grateful. That would also be, oh yeah, yeah. Maybe he did have bad intentions. I feel like a schnorr. He restored her dignity. Maybe in her mind she starts thinking, yeah, maybe he had some. You know, like, why not paint him as a villain? Why should you paint yourself as somebody who received? We like to be givers, we like to be benefactors, we like to be a somebody. So Rus doesn't like, it's not like that. Rus represents a person who has worked on herself, and she is in righteously indignant that it would be even a suggestion that Boaz did anything other than help her, and she is wholly appreciative. Beautiful thing. Right? So now this pasuk just telling us, we learned about anxiety, we learned about anger, we learned frustration, we learned about appreciation, but it's all getting a picture of the personalities. This is the conversation is telling us much more than the actual words. Now, another possibility in this conversation was when she notices, when Naomi notices what happened over here, and she was able to do all these things, she also notices that the chaff has been truncated from the actual grain. Remember, she pounded the grain to separate it. Why did she do that? Because she didn't want to attract attention. And she was a little big, very heavy. She was carrying the big weight. She wanted to try to minimize, compact, make it more compact, so she should be able to get home modestly, discreetly, and bring all the food home. So the Yigeta Shmuel says, Naomi notices this. And she says, not only did you gain so much, so clearly somebody must have been very nice to you to let you gather so much. Like, you seem to have had a free hand, which she did, of course. She seems to have had a free hand. But he says, not only this, you also took the time to pound the grain. You separated the grain from the stalk. She says, separating the grain from the stalk, they don't usually let you do that in the field. Who let you do that? So there's the gleanings, and then there's the packaging. She got the grain, then she knocked off all the stalks. And that, says the Geresh Shmuel, is the meaning of a redundant question. She notes that, number one, likat hayoyim, in one day you get an eifa. Number two, anasis, who let you do this in their field? Clearly you must have felt comfortable to start to all of a sudden, you know, roll your sleeves up and you're sending a banging grain. Who does that? You're allowed, you're a guest, you're a stranger. Somebody allowed you to do something, you take whatever you can get. You don't ask for extra things. So you should have just taken and left. But instead, you felt comfortable there. The fact that you felt comfortable to separate the grain from the stalks, Naomi notes with tremendous intuition, is a sign that somebody has been very kind to you today. And that's why she says right away, Yehi makirech baruch. Whoever was nice to you like that, I bless them. So what do we know about Naomi now? Number one, she's extreme intuition. She thinks very quickly. She figured out, she sized up a situation, and momentarily, right away, she notices things. And also, she's appreciative. She's already blessing the unknown benefactor, because that's what we should be. Somebody did something to you, bless them, thank them. Naomi's already blessing them. And when somebody does something nice, what's the basic? In English, people say, thank you. What do we say in Hebrew when somebody does something? That's in Ivrit. What do we say in Hebrew? What in Torah language, somebody does something for you, what do you say? Yasher koach. What does Yasher koach mean? More strength to you. It's a blessing. Thank you is polite. Yasher koach is a blessing. Somebody did something for you, you try to do what you can do back. What can you do back? You give them a bracha. They helped you. Bless them. Naomi teaches us this. She doesn't say, oh, she says, thank Hashem. No. There was somebody who made a decision here. Okay, I'll thank him. I don't know who to thank. That doesn't mean you can't say Yasher koach. Blessed be whoever did this. So you don't even need to know who your benefactor is to thank them. Because in Torah, you know, you don't say thank you. You bless them. Somebody did something for you. You don't know who it is. I bless whoever did this. And you never know the koach of a bracha, the power of a blessing. A blessing uttered with sincerity could bring good things for others. So bless them. Now we have like an idea. Let's take a look at it. So Rashi says like this. What is Yehi Makirich Baruch? Rashi says, Baal Hasada Shenosav Nosan Lachponim Lilkit Besadehu. I bless the owner of the field, not who recognized you. See, it can be understood in two ways. Makirich can be the one who recognized you, the one who was nice to you. Umakirich can be not a noun, but a verb. Makirich means he was kind to you. He did extend recognition. Recognition as not in, recognize you for who you are. Like, I don't ignore you. He gave her, it's called hakedus panim, means to extend to somebody favor, to show favor to somebody. So not that the makirech, the person who was kind to you, but for the graciousness that they showed you. And so Rashi says, habal asada shenosa, v'nosan l'chapanim, who gave you face, who gave you grace, who allowed you, lilka b'sadeyu, clearly you had to be comfortable in that field to be able to do the things you did. And you were comfortable, and you did do it. That's very big. That means a lot. That says a lot. Now, once we're on the lines of this whole notion, this idea of her having been able to gather so much and be so successful and so on and so forth. So here, we have a something else, a phenomenal something else. Eshkol HaKofer brings us down his commentary. I think Vilna Gaon brings down his commentary also. It says like this. Let me preface again with the mother-in-law jokes. So nobody's ever good enough for a woman's son. No. That's why she doesn't like their son. Not good enough for my son. Okay. But what Naomi says here is the exact opposite. Naomi says, you're an amazing woman, she says. You're unbelievable, Rus. You went and did this in one day. You pulled this off. She says, Yeki makire, whoever's going to get to know you, which is a euphemism, whoever's going to get you as a wife is Baruch, is blessed. You will be a blessing to somebody. In other words, Naomi is noting the fact that Rus is extremely versatile, can adjust herself to a situation, and has amazing work ethic. There's something amazing about you, she says. She never knew Rus in this capacity. Back in Moab, Rus is a princess. She has everything she could possibly want. Here, Rus has stuck to her mother-in-law, clung the whole journey home, never fetched a complaint, Zugesund. Your people are my people. Your way is my way. And then she comes, and then she's turned into a pauper the next day. She's turned into a pauper. And she knows that Moabites are not beloved in Israel. And she's not going to be accepted. Or she doesn't know she'll ever be accepted. And she goes off to a field. She's never done this in her life. She never stuck her hand out in her life. And in one day, she goes out, and all of a sudden, she turns this around. She says, this is what's called an Ashes Chayil. You're a real Ashes Chayil, she says. Whoever's getting you as a husband someday is going to be a very lucky man. A wife, pardon me. He'll be a very lucky man. That's a nice compliment, isn't it? From a mother-in-law to give a daughter-in-law. That's nice. And also, remember, her son died. So there's a little bit of pain. She's already talking. She's hoping good things. She's telling Ruth, I want you to be happy. I want you to find a new husband. I want you to get married. And he's going to be so lucky to be able to get you. None of this is that intuitive. None of this comes naturally. But that is, of course, the point. The point of, we study Megillas Susa on Shavuos, and during the days of the Sefiras HaOmer, which is about, this happened exactly at the time of Sefiras HaOmer. The narrative begins when they're counting the Omer. When they come to Beit Lechem, there's huge crowds there cutting the Omer. This is when the Omer, this whole story now is going to take place during the days of the Omer. And what do we see? We see the exquisite personalities of Naomi and Rus, which speak to extraordinary refinement that's not by default. Refinement that's worked on. Refinement that's developed. Incredible personality traits. Beautiful characteristics. So, no, Rus responds, and she says to Chamaisa, "V'tagel Chamaisa Esa she'asa sa'imai." She says, she tells him what she did with him. Now, to explain this to you better, I have to share with you the words of our sages. This is found in the Gemara. It's found also in the Alkot Shemayni, and it says like this: Yoiser mima shahabal habayis oisa im ha'oni, ha'oni oisa. In Baal HaBayis, freely translated, more than the benefactor does for the recipient does for the benefactor. How could that be? Because it's nice to be able to get the handout when you need it, but it's even a bigger schus to be able to give the handout, to be able to provide the hospitality, to be able to give the tzedakah is even a bigger schus. It's even the merit is even greater than the funds or the foodstuff that was given. And the Gemara says like this: We know this from Megillas Rus. B'shekein Amro l'Naomi. Imagine Rus is not even she's not even like fully Jewish yet. She didn't undergo the full conversion yet. Her conversion needs an upgrade still. Because in Moab, there wasn't a Bezdin. It wasn't a proper conversion. Rus is still in the middle of the process. And she's going to be fully converting. And she becomes, like we learned about this early on in the beginning. Rus was you learn the story of conversion, what's necessary for conversion from the story of Rus. And yet, the Gemara is teaching us lessons, Torah lessons from Rus's behavior. Who's not even a full-fledged Yehudiyash, not even a full-fledged convert yet. It says, What does Rus say to Naomi? Ha'ish asher asisi imoi, the man with whom I did. What does it mean with whom I did? Asher asa imi, ain sivkan. Doesn't say he did for me. Asher asisi imoi, I did for him. Pu'ulois harbe pa'alte imoi beprusa shachilani. I did a lot of good things with a little bit, a handful of grain I ate. I brought him wonderful blessings from Hashem. And Rus says this at the same time that she's so grateful to Boaz. So grateful that she's offended that her mother-in-law would suggest that Boaz has anything but best of intentions. But at the same time, Rus also understood that for Boaz, it was a zechut. But that didn't take away her appreciation. It was a zechus for him. And the fact that he gave her, and the fact that he restored her dignity, he himself didn't even know what he did. There's a famous Gemara that talks about, in the Maseches Tainus, about a sage whose name is Abba Chilkiah. And Abba Chilkiah was a simple laborer. He worked on a field. He worked for somebody. And the story goes, these two chachamim come from Yerushalayim. They were sent to ask Abba Chilkiah to daven for rain because Israel needed rain. And they come to Abba Chilkiah and he doesn't talk to them. He doesn't answer them. And then and he does all kind of funny things on the way. Comes to the water, takes his shoes off. He does all strange things. And then finally he talks to them and he explains why he did everything. He explains, I'm getting paid by the hour. Paid by the hour, I can't talk to you. I would be violating my contract. And Abba Chilkiah goes to one side in Davins, and his wife goes to the other side in Davins. And the rain clouds come from their prayers, but it comes first to the side of the house that his wife is on. So they ask him, how come her prayers got answered first? And Abba Chilkiah says, because when a poor person comes to me, I give them cash. When a poor person comes to the house, she gives them food. So therefore, her tzedakah is higher. And we have the same sentiment in the story about Reb Meir and his wife Beruria, that they were very, very charitable people to the point of self-sacrifice. And they used to want to give tzedakah anonymously. So what they would do is, they would go to people that they knew were very needy, and they would wrap food packages and run away. Nobody should know who they got it from, so as not to take away their dignity. But there was one person who was really curious to know where, who he wanted to know who Eliyahu HaNavi was. Who kept dropping these packages? Maybe he thought it was Eliyahu HaNavi. Let's see, an angel. I don't know. He decided to hide, and then when they were coming close, he ran out of his hiding place. They started to run away because they didn't want him to be embarrassed by seeing their face. And in the center of the town, there were these large ovens, industrial ovens. And the industrial ovens were used by this, today people, most people don't have their own pool. Once upon a time, who had a pool? You went to the city pool. Today everybody has an oven. Once upon a time, people went to the industrial ovens. Nobody had an oven. That was part of the municipal services they provided. And there were large ovens, large enough for a person to go inside. And I'm not sure exactly what they looked like, but large. And Beruria and Reb Meir jump into this oven. Now the oven is, it's already evening and there's just embers. But it's still an oven. And it was very hot in there. And Reb Meir's sandals get burnt and his feet blister. But Beruria's feet don't blister. Incidentally, how do we learn this behavior? From another very righteous woman whose name is Tamar. Tamar was pregnant by Yehuda, but she didn't want to embarrass Yehuda. And the rationale behind the story is that really that was a form of levirate marriage, but Yehuda didn't know this at the time. So but technically didn't do the wrong thing, but it looked like the wrong thing. It looked totally... And Tamar said, Hakerna. She sent him over his artifacts and said, you notice these artifacts. You notice it? If you own up to this, that's fine. If you don't, okay, I'll get burnt. I'm not going to embarrass you. Can you imagine how the extent not to embarrass somebody? Embarrass people like nothing today. We boast about how we embarrass people today. And these tzaddikim ready to get burnt, not to embarrass somebody. So that's how they knew to jump into an oven, from the behavior of Tama. So afterwards, the mayor says to his wife, look, we jumped in, whatever, but look at you. My feet got burnt. How can you have burnt feet? She says, because my tzedakah is better than yours. He says, that's not fair. We give tzedakah together. He says, yeah, but when somebody comes to you, you give him some cash. He says, I give food. The food is a higher level of tzedakah. Okay. There's a mimer from the Rebbe. The Rebbe says that the Gemara tells us that the shulchan, the table of today, takes the place of the mizbeach, the altar of the Beis HaMikdash. And there's two reasons in the Achronim. There's the Marsha talks about this Gemara, and there's also a Sefer called Talas Yaakov that give answers to this Gemara to explain it. So one of the answers is that the poor people come to the table. The table is a vehicle to feed those who are needy. And sometimes it's not needy for food. Sometimes it's needy for company. Invite somebody over to your table. Shouldn't have to eat alone. So the Rebbe says that the truth is, it's possible that that's the highest form of tzedakah of all. And he brings down this Gemara with Abba Chilkia. And he cross-references the story of the mayor. But he says over there was a difference in giving cash or giving food. He didn't just give food. He gave a fork and a knife and a setting and a chair. You have a person, you didn't say, here's some food. Where am I eating it? Do I have to worry about that too? Munch a sandwich wherever you are, I don't know. He says, no, you invite the person in, sit in down and commence, the highest form of tzedakah. At any rate, this is where we learn it from. So Rus was brought into the home. They gave her lunch. The highest form of tzedakah, actually. Like the Rebbe says in that mimer. It's the higher form even than food. So Rus wasn't only given food to keep body and soul together, to still her hunger. She had her dignity restored to her. And when the Gemara talks about different levels of tzedakah, which the Rambam codifies into 8 different levels of tzedakah, so one of the details in tzedakah is to use kind words. The Gemara says, what if somebody comes to you, asks you, have nothing to give? You should say kind words. Does it hurt to be friendly? Does it hurt to smile? I'm sorry, I don't have it. I'm not able to help you, but I hope Hashem blesses you. And I hope in the future you'll be giving other people money. What did it cost you? But I don't have any money. Don't, then give what you could. We see from this kind words a part of the giving. Boaz is very kind. She really took care of Ruth, made her feel like a mensch again. And you could only imagine that feeling of inadequacy, the feeling of being a stranger, the feeling of not belonging. We know this because the Torah says that it's forbidden to shame or embarrass or harass or take advantage of a fellow Yid. And if it's a convert, it's twice as bad. Not one Aveda, it's called Ainoa. There's Ainoa's Devarim, to use your words to harass and take advantage of somebody else. And then there's Ainoa's Hager, which is twice as bad. Ona'a comes two different mitzvahs. Then there's anaras mammon, it's taking advantage of somebody financially. That's a separate thing. But the idea that Rus, the Sefer Chinuch explains, why is there a separate mitzvah for a convert? Because a convert feels always, they have a low self-esteem. Could you imagine Rus's self-esteem? Number one, a princess became a pauper. Number two, a Moabite. First of all, she's not Jewish. She came to the Jewish people. But not Jewish. This is the age-old enemies of the Jewish people, Moab. And who officially the law is that Moabites can't marry Israelites, even if they convert. Her self-esteem must have been on the ground. And Boaz did so much with her. Boaz, he gave her kind words and he gave her food. He made her feel like a mensch. And Ruth is appreciative. She told her mother-in-law. But at the same time, she understood what a zuchus, what a merit it was for Boaz. And there's a Gemara that tells us that when it comes to tzedakah, like anything else, you got to have mazel. We could both give the same dollar. The question is, who got the dollar? Sometimes you gave the dollar to a charlatan, or sometimes you gave it to somebody who needed it a little, and sometimes you had the schus to give it to somebody who really needed that dollar. You know, sometimes you have the good fortune, the schus, that you were able to help somebody in their time of need. That's something to thank Hashem for. Something to thank Hashem. Somebody once came to me, many years after the story happened, and reminded me of a certain story, which I didn't remember. And said to me, those words you said made me feel so good and worked things out. And my response was, thank you for telling it to me, but I'm so grateful I had the chance. Like, what did it cost me? For a change, I didn't drop the boy, did the right thing. But it's like a Baruch Hashem. It's a schus. We should see it as a schus. To help somebody else is a gift, not a burden. To be able to make a difference in somebody's life is a wonderful privilege. And we see this from the Gemara. And the Gemara sees it from Rus. Whereas you see how Rus says, Asher asasa imoi. She told her mother-in-law what she did for him, meaning what happened here. What happened? This is a shortened way of saying what happened here, and that says what he did, what she did. She said to her mother-in-law how low she felt, how difficult it was. This is a very meaningful conversation. It's just alluded to in a few words. And now, Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, understands what happened. But then she says softly, "Vatoyimer Shem Ha'ish." Do you know who did this? You know who this person is? Asher Asisi Imai Hayoim, the person who did all this, I did all this with today. His name is Boaz. Oh, Boaz. She didn't want to say it in the beginning because Boaz is the relative of Naomi. Now, if Naomi's going to hear that it was a relative who gave her handouts or took care, maybe Naomi's feelings are going to be hurt. Maybe she feels like a schnorrer. That now she had to come to her own family. It's very uncomfortable to have to go to family and stick your hand out. So Ruth very gently, as she's telling her mother-in-law, in the same sentence, Vatagit, in the same sentence, she doesn't want to tell him his name right away. First she says how nice, and she says, what I did for him. Why does she have to say what I did for him? It's not for lack of appreciation. She doesn't want Naomi to feel like a schnorrer. She wants Naomi to feel good about everything that happened. She said, we were able to provide them with a schus. And then she says softly, and the name of this person is Boaz. And here, Rabbeinu Moshe Alshech says something amazing. He says, famous question is, his name is not Boaz. His name is Itzvan. His name is Itzvan. He's identified as Itzvan. And he's identified clearly as a different person. So if he's a different person, then for heaven's sake, why don't we identify him as the person that he really is? Why call him a different name? And the answer is like this. It says, Salmon gave birth to Itzvan. Itzvan, the Targum says, Itzvan, the Targum says, is Boaz, in whose merit Israel was delivered from their enemies. So the name Boaz is what they call a nam de gur. It's kind of like descriptive name. It's not his birth name. It's not his real name. Why do people give descriptive names? So there's two reasons. It depends who gives the name. Some people give themselves descriptive names, and that's usually because they're egomaniacs. Or sometimes people are called a descriptive name. And the descriptive name describes how other people view and see them. Let me give you an example of a famous Jew in our time who had a descriptive name. Many people don't know his name till today. Did you ever hear of a great Sephardic tzaddik whose name was Baba Sali? You know what Baba Sali means? It's a holy father. You think Baba Sali called himself Baba Sali? He said, "Hi, I'm Baba Sali. I'm your holy father. No, of course not. They looked at him. It says that a Rav, that a teacher was like a father, and they looked at him and they called him Abba Kadisha. They said, this is how the people saw him. The Jews of Morocco who he led were in awe of his holiness. And he didn't have an office that he occupied. He didn't have a position necessarily. I mean, he was a rabbi at a certain point in one of the towns in Morocco, but who replaced Baba Sali? Really nobody. Yes, he does have a son who lives in Netivot, and it's a position that was, he was bigger than the position. He didn't have a position. He was Baba Sali. He didn't have to have an office, or an organization. He was sought out from all across Israel. Why? Because of his holiness. Because people knew this, a tzaddik. So a name like that is a name that people give, but the name like that people give, it says something about how people saw him. It's not a secret that if somebody knows something about American Jewish life, or I would say even Jewish life today, if you say the Rebbe, for 99% of people know who you're talking about. If you don't use a title in the beginning. The Rebbe never called himself the Rebbe. But he was seen as the Rebbe. What's a Rebbe? Rebbe is Reish Bnei Yisrael. A Rebbe is a person who cares about every single Yid. A person who worries about the nation on every macro, micro level. People saw that. People gave the name. Who called Boaz Boaz? He didn't call himself Boaz. The people called him Boaz. Why did they call him Boaz? They called him Boaz because Boaz is a conjunctive form, says the Alshech. It comes from the word Oz. What does Oz mean?
Strength.
Bez Oz, he was the strong one, the deliverer, the savior of the Jewish people, twice. When did he save them? Number one, he defended them from their enemies. He was also a military person. He led them in battle. Number two, when there was economic collapse, it was Boaz's efforts that saved multitudes from starvation. So they looked at Boaz, they said he saved them on two counts. So how did they call him? Boaz, Bez Oz, the two incredible things of strength. So Ruth is really then, the Alshech says, responding further to Naomi. Naomi thought, maybe it wasn't well-intentioned, this guy who helped you. So first of all, she said, Asher Asisa Imei. This is all zuchut, she says, all meritorious. He got the greatest of merits. It was only when if he got merits for doing something, what does that tell you? He did it l'shem shamayim. If he wasn't doing it l'shem shamayim, you get merits. You get a merit when you do it wholeheartedly. You do it for the sake of heaven. So the first thing Ruth tells Naomi is, I did for him. I did for him means that he did a wonderful mitzvah. It was all l'shem shamayim for the sake of heaven. And because it was for the sake of heaven, how could you think he was anything but the purest of intentions? But number two, she softly says, and you know who this guy is? This is Boaz. This is the person who always helps others. And in saying this, she says, you blessed him. Indeed, he is deserving of blessing. She ratifies, she says, indeed. She says, Boaz. She doesn't say Itzvan. If his name is Itzvan, say Itzvan. Why did she use the Nam de Gur? I mean, presumably Naomi knew him as a child. She would have known him by his first name, by his natural name, because he speaks to her about how the people called him. Because Ruth wants Naomi to understand how it's beyond the slightest imagination that he would have done anything for any kind of chas v'shalom gain, or because he had anything different in mind by looking at Ruth. That is. Now this very wordy conversation, a very wordy pasuk with a lot of talking, but now you have at least not the whole rest of the story, but somewhat of the rest of the story, what's compacted into this incredible verse of pasuk Yotes, the beginning of the conversation of Ruth and of Naomi and Ruth upon her return.
It's interesting how the story is telling us in Beth Aleph